Let's see. Okay. All right. First thing I want to do is just pass out here to you some flyers that I see sitting here, which means to me that this is a gentle nudge that I'm supposed to pass them out to plug something. Which is to say that there's another, the center runs intensive mediation classes, classes on clinical mediation. There's one coming up in March, and I think right now they're at this point where there's, I think, just three or four spaces that are left in it. Take it, look at it. If you're interested, let Autumn know that you're interested. If you're not, scrap paper, reverse side. So that's what it's there for. Today we've got several things to get through. We're talking today about, in particular, memories and memoirs. This is the title of today's class, which is to say that we're talking about, you know, the most sort of introductory and general sense of what it means to reflect on one's encounter in the clinic, if you will. To that end, we're going to do, just to give the breakdown, we're going to talk about the poem by John Donne first, the meditation number 4 from Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions. We're going to then shift to talk about Arthur Frank's The Wounded Storyteller, and here I want to just sort of have us go through it in a kind of semi-swift way to look at some kind of cheat sheet sort of ways to find key ways he asks us to pause and think about ways of reading. Then we're going to look at Dully's My Lobotomy, which is an account of his experience of having a lobotomy, and look at some key moments in there. And here we're actually going to be looking at a fewer number of episodes and lingering at greater length, thanks so much, on some of those episodes to talk about the procedure itself. And then if we have time, we're going to talk about Walter Benjamin's Storyteller in combination with the episode I had you read from Edmund White's My Lives, called My Therapists. Now, it sounds like it's a lot of reading, which it is, but what the point of today's class is to talk about is the different ways that we as patients or we as individuals reflect on or remember and therefore record also our clinical encounters. To that end, these are all three different narratives, and I'm putting aside the Frank and the Benjamin right now, but the Dunn and the Dully and the White are all examples of what I would say what we think of as our instinctive knee-jerk reaction to what constitutes a medical narrative, which is to what was my experience like in the clinic or in the therapist's room or in the encounter with a doctor, which is to say that our first reaction is to think that medical narratives are there to provide that supplementary voice of the patient, so to speak, and even more specific than that, that voice of the patient in terms of when they think about their clinician or their medical encounter. What's interesting then is that the point of our class this entire semester then is to think about the range of different kinds of storytellings that happen both about the clinic and within the clinic. Stories that are told in order to comment on the clinic and also to function within it. Having said that, I think the first kind of way we think about medical narratives in its very traditional sense is to think about it as almost like the equivalent of like when you take your evaluation at the end of a course, when you're, you know, what did you think of the course? Medical narratives are first reactions to think, what did you think of the medical encounter? And that's what we're looking at today then, to think about that. And then taking that kind of narrative and from here on out seeing how many different ways is there narratives that are told about the clinic. To that end, these are all narratives about clinical encounters, but they're ones that are very physician or clinician sort of centered, which is definitely not a model for what we're doing this semester, but it is a good place to start in the sense that how each of these authors today, Dunn, and White, and Dully, how they understand their experience, their clinical encounter, is to think, well, how did I feel about my clinician? So we have at the end, White literally talking about a piece called My Therapist, where he just kind of goes through the different therapists he has. We have in the middle, Dully talking about My Lobotomy, but it really might as well be called My Relationship with Dr. Freeman, because it's really about that working that out. And then we start here with John Donne, which is about the Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions, and this is meditation number 4, which is subtitled in Latin and then in English, The Physician is Sent For. I don't know if many of you have read much John Donne, or have even read much from the Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions. Donne was probably one of, if not the best poets, writing in 17th century England. Like his time, Donne was someone who oscillated quite a bit in his faith, whether to be Anglican or Catholic, and so that struggle about where to attach one's devotion or one's connection was really at the core. In his case, though, he was also in servant and was also a preacher too. And he just to say that all of his verse, all of his prose writings, and all of his memoirs, and all of his speeches even, have to them a level of kind of reverence, but also a kind of spiritual crisis, if you will, because they're kind of like trying to sort out where my heart is supposed to be and where my loyalty is supposed to be. He's most famous for his short poems, but also for his sermons. The Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions are kind of an unusual sort of phenomenon for him because they're really just a rumination on a moment for him. This piece, this whole series of devotions was written by Donne probably when he was in about his, I don't know, 40s or early 50s maybe, at a moment when he became quite ill. And at a moment in which he actually thought he was going to die, and what he did was obviously went through the experience of thinking he was on death's door and then wrote these series of devotions. And the devotions are each
a different meditation, a meditation with each of a different subtitle, thinking I'm sick or wishing there was God or finally thinking about the afterlife or what have you. And there's probably about 20 of them, I think. And devotion number 4 is interesting because it's the one we're looking at because it's about what a physician is sent for. Now, bear in mind as we read this then, it's not when the physician arrives, it's not after the physician has told me what's wrong with me, it's after I know I'm going to die or I've been given a prognosis or what have you. It's the, holy shit, I think I'm sick. Somebody call a physician. Now I'm going to sit down, parchment, paper, and quill, and write this sort of devotion, if you will. So it's about being on the precipice, if you will, of the clinical encounter. This is the person who is not quite a patient, because the doctor is not here yet, but is already a sick person. So straddling that divide, which is to say that it's the voice of the person at their most worrisome, if you will, what potentially could happen, but also uncertain about what could be lying ahead. This devotion then has an interesting sort of purpose because what it does then for us is provide a kind of like blueprint, if you will, at least in Dunn's case, for how he thinks what it's going to be like to go into this particular clinical encounter. I'm going to have us read this out loud together, in particular the entirety of part one and parts of part three, so that we can see the different ways in which Dunn breaks down his understanding of this particular moment. So I'm going to start by reading the first paragraph that we have here. And as I read it, I want you to think of, pay attention to, you know, what Dunn is doing here is we're doing a lot of metaphor, but in particular, this first section, which doesn't even mention the physician. Remember, bear in mind, it's the subtitle is Physician is Sent For. But the first paragraph is laying a groundwork for where the physician has to enter. And where this is Dunn just starts to think about his own body and how important and what magnitude it has. It is too little to call man a little world. Except God, man is a diminutive to nothing. Man consists of more pieces, more parts than the world doth, nay, than the world is. And if those pieces were extended and stretched out in man as they are in the world, man would be the giant and the world the dwarf, the world but the map, and the man the world. If all the veins in our bodies were extended to rivers, and all the sinews to veins of minds, and all the muscles that lie upon one another to hills, and all the bones to quarries of stones, and all the other pieces to the proportion of those which correspond to them in the world, the air would be too little for this orb of man to move in. The firmament would be but enough for this star. For as the whole world hath nothing to which something in man doth not answer, so hath man many pieces of which the whole world hath no representation. Enlarge this meditation upon this great world, man, so far as to consider the immensity of the creatures this world produces. Our creatures are our thoughts, creatures that are born giants, that reach from east to west, from earth to heaven, that do not only bestride all the sea and land, but span the sun and firmament at once. My thoughts reach all, comprehend all. What would you say is this the core sentiment, then, of this paragraph that Dunn is giving us?
How complex man is, I guess, and his body, and how complicated it is.
How complicated the body is, how complex it is, how profound it is, and even literally how big it is. And how he thinks of that bigness is both in terms of its importance, but also, as you said, its very complexity. So the extended metaphor that's happening here is thinking about how big the world is, right? And then putting in contrast to how big the world is, how important man is. Now, the importance of the body, then, is the way that the details are being talked about, the sinews and the veins and the muscles and the ligature and all that sort of stuff. So that if we have here, hold on, Florida, right? And Greenland. Okay. If we have the world here, right? The importance is how big the world, how magnificent it is, how large it is, and how there's actually quite an equation that can be made between the complexity of one's body and the complexity of the world. But Dunn is taking that metaphor even further by saying, not just as there's something in man's body, so there is a counterpart in the world. The veins are the rivers and the muscles are the mountains and the gullies are the this or that, but actually saying that there are things in the human body that actually outweigh, extend, are even greater than the world itself. So that in the scale of things here, we have the world, and then we have next to it, if you will, the body, which is the person, which actually now dwarfs, if you will, the world. So magnificent, so large to some degree, so complex, is the body, then it actually sort of minimizes the world. Now again, remember where we're talking from. We're talking from a physician is sent for. We're talking from a moment just before the physician is supposed to come and a moment of great health crisis, which is to say that what Dunn is really riffing on here, I think, is how important our bodies are, how important and complex and how much we rely on that complexity of our bodies. When we're sick or we're on the precipice of being sick, how many of us, especially those of us who are not clinicians, have had that moment where we never for a second think about, you know, how pulmonary things work or how renal things work or what have you. But the minute we're sick, we are obsessed with how complex our bodies are. Sickness prompts in us an almost over-exaggerated appreciation of the magnitude of this. So big, Dunn says, that it even dwarfs the world itself, I think is what he's saying. But I'll tell you what Dunn's also doing here too, one of his moves. He's totally doing what I call the Highlights Magazine move. You know Highlights Magazine, that kids magazine, or Nickelodeon, right? Whenever they do science for kids, they always do this thing, ready? If you took all the blood vessels in your body and extended them all stretched out, you could go to the moon and back 6 times, right? They always do that. That's the way they relate to kids, working with science and how big and how complex your body is. Totally what Dunn is doing. He did it 500 years before Nickelodeon, that's all. Now, thinking about that groundwork and that setting that we have here in terms of thinking about the complexity and such, let's look at the second paragraph here, which brings in a little bit of a riff. So we start by taking thinking about the body. In paragraph 2, now we're thinking about sort of the villain, if you will, here, the threat to that body. Inexplicable mystery. I, their creator, am in a close prison, in a sick bed, anywhere, and any one of my creatures, my thoughts, is with the sun, and beyond the sun, overtakes the sun, and overgoes the sun in one pace, one step, everywhere. Pause for a second. You'll notice there's almost a kind of hubris or overconfidence in the voice here of Dunn about how, if anybody's read Whitman, have you ever read Leaves of Grass or Song of Myself? I don't know. Whitman writes, I'll give you an example. There's two main poets in American literature that we talk about, especially 19th century. Whitman and anybody? Woman? Recluse? Emily Dickinson. No. So Whitman, Emily Dickinson writes like this, right? That's an Emily Dickinson poem. Done, right? It's short, it's concise, it's profound, it's haunting, it's lovely. Here's Whitman, ready? Line 1, line 2. So long, expansive, can't fit on the page, and Whitman's poetry always sounds like this. I am America, and America is me. This country thinks it is something, but I inhabited it in its entirety. It's so hubristic. It's so, because it's about citizenry. It's about Americans. It's about owning the entire escape with the pants of it. I think Dunn created the playbook, if you will, for Whitman, because this moment in here is thinking about one's own body as almost inhabiting the entire world. So ironically, what Whitman nationalizes at the level of Americanness in verse, I think Dunn almost globalizes in terms of thinking about the body in some way. I'm going to continue with paragraph 2 because you would think with all that hubris and all that boasting that one would think he is insurmountable. Look how big he is dwarfing the world. But guess what? The irony here is the wrench in this example is the fact that how fragile that big body is at the same time. And then as the other world produces serpents and vipers, malignant and venomous creatures, and worms and caterpillars, that endeavor to devour that world which produces them, and monsters compiled and complicated of diverse parents and kinds, so this world, ourselves, produces all these in us, in producing diseases and sicknesses of all those sorts, venomous and infectious diseases, feeding and consuming diseases, and manifold and entangled diseases made up of so many several ones. And can the other world name so many venomous, so many consuming, so many monstrous creatures as we can diseases of all these kinds? O miserable abundance, O beggarly riches, how much do we lack of having remedies for every disease, when as yet we have not names for them? Now this is important here. So that what we're talking about, this is before germ theory, this is before viral theory, this is for bacterial theory. What we're talking about here is what in that body that's dwarfing the globe up there might also be producing these very things that could defeat it to some degree. We're living at a time medically where we would refer to the kind of medical thought at this time, if you're familiar with this term, as humoral. Is everybody familiar with the theory of the humors? Humoral or the humors, there we are, the humors, blood, black bile, white bile, that sort of thing, right? Phlegm, the fourth one. And which is to say, just to give you a little short rundown, you don't even know the entire history, but going back to even Galen and Hippocrates, what really led throughout Western medicine, and actually Middle Eastern medicine too, because Galen was disseminated just as much throughout the Arab world,
was to think then that what we have is a kind of theory about the body and about health that depends upon less whether you are infected with something and whether or not your body is or is or not out of balance in some degree. So almost up until, I would say, from about antiquity all the way up until about the 17th and even early 18th century, the large theory about one's illness depended to some degree about whether or not you had too much, an abundance of too much fluid or one kind of spirit, if you will, in you, or if you had a dearth to some other degree. This is why you'll see, for example, in old pictures from the 17th century, they'll be doing things like bleeding somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Because they thought you had an overabundance or something in you. Therefore, the job of the physician or the clinician then was to figure out what you had too much or too little of and to try to set that right, to work out that balance. I'm not going to go into too much detail explain that, except to say that this is why Dunn is saying that where these diseases come from, their source might actually be from the person themselves. So it's not about an individual being infected with an illness, as Dunn is talking about here. It's rather that the majesty and the grandness of this world also has within it the possibility to lead towards bad things. So too does this body and its grandness have the possibility to produce what he calls here the serpents and diseases and venoms, if you will, to some degree. To that end, he's still boasting about the body. He's still boasting about how complex and great it is. But what he's done now and added to its bag of tricks is that it also can defeat itself. Which is to say that it's like you went to a shop and showed somebody a car and it showed all the great equipment it had and all the great features, and then you said it also has a self-destruct button, right? That's basically what he's saying here. There's a way in which there's something also endowed in this body, endowed in this great complex body we have, but also can be self-defeated. Now, Dunn is writing three paragraphs here for the physician is sent for, but he's also doing a classic setup of how a drama is created. If anybody knows a playwright or has read lots of plays, start off, you set the groundwork. Start two, you bring in the complex problem. Start part three, you bring in the solution. And paragraph three is the solution. And of course, we have it here in the figure of the next enter stage left, the physician. But we have a Hercules against these giants, these monsters. That is the physician. I'll pause there for a second, just to say that everything we read this semester is not going to be poo-pooing physicians or doctors or what have you, although a lot of medical narratives do talk about how shitty my clinical encounter was. But if you're looking for good compliments of physicians, drink it up now, because this is, it doesn't get bigger than this, right? So big does it not get that, and I'm going to draw this now. I usually do this after I read this paragraph. I'm going to do it now. In this comparison that we have here, with the addition of the physician, now we have, right? The physician, if you will, right? Sort of dwarfing everything else. So large now is the world, so large is the body, and in comparison now is the Hercules of the physician. That's how big he is. So I'm going to start reading this paragraph again and again. If you're looking for boastful things, clinicians in here, drink it up. Here we go. But we have a Hercules against these giants, these monsters. That is the physician. He musters up all the forces of the other world to succor this, all nature to relieve man. We have the physician, but we are not the physician. Here we shrink in our proportion, sink in our dignity and respect of every mean creatures who are physicians to themselves. The hart, or deer, that is pursued and wounded, they say, knows an herb which, being eaten, throws off the arrow, a strange kind of vomit. The dog that pursues it, though he be subject to sickness, even proverbially knows his grasses that recovers him. And it may be true that the drugger is as near to man as to other creatures, and may be that obvious and present simples, easy to be had, would cure him. But the apothecary is not so near him, nor the physician so near him, as they too are to other creatures. This is where he's been basically euphemistically praising how animals, and sometimes instinctively, almost know how to cure themselves. You know, a deer is not as smart as a human being and nowhere near as endowed with grace and majesty, but a deer gets shot with an arrow and proverbially they say he knows what to do to heal himself. Why does a man have that? That's why we need the physician, he's saying. So, man hath not that innate instinct to apply these natural medicines to his present danger, as those inferior creatures have. He is not his own apothecary, his own physician, as they are. Call back, therefore, thy meditation again and bring it down. What's become of man's great extent and proportion when himself shrinks himself and consumes himself to a handful of dust? What's become of his soaring thoughts, his compassing thoughts, when himself brings himself to the ignorance, to the thoughtlessness of the grave? His diseases are his own, but the physician is not.
He hath them at home, but he must send for the physician. That's a very good way to end, because meditation five is the physician has arrived, right? So it's rather a grand introduction, if you will. But I think it sets up for us a really important way that one can think about at this moment, at the precipice of this clinical encounter, as the physician as being absolutely this figure that needs to come in and not just be heroic, if you will, to some degree, but in some way also salvage, if you will, the stakes and the magnitude of the particular situation. Now, having said that, I love this piece because I think Dunn really is being sincere here in how much he's boasting up and anticipating the physician. At the same time, though, it's absolutely dependent, I think, circumstantially on the fact that a physician is being sent for, which is to say, I do not think Dunn is like the president of the Physician's Fan Club at this particular time, right? I don't think he spends every day thinking all these great thoughts about the physician. This is a story, this is a narrative, this is a testimonial, if you will, about what does it mean to be sick and on the verge of figuring out what's wrong with me. And suddenly, almost giving himself and at the same time the physician a pep talk, he's putting all of his confidence and all of his boasting, I think, into the physician here at this moment, which is to say that really this testimonial here is less an assessment of how people thought about physicians at this time than it is how people in general, I think, across times, tend to cast their physicians at a particular moment and try to endow them with all of the grace and all of the talent and all of the expectation that they can, because, and I don't think it's wishful thinking, I think it's hopeful thinking to some degree. And I mention this because this is going to be an overarching thing about our class. We're talking about patients, we're talking about caregivers, we're talking about laypersons, but of course we're also talking about professionals too. When we think about the characters, if you will, because these are all narratives, right? Some of them are fiction, but even the non-fictional stuff is still a rendering, it's a perspective. How do we cast the physician? In what light do we shed that person? Is it as an antagonist? Is it as a protagonist? Is it as somebody that we're trying to evaluate? Or is it somebody that just happens to be a secondary sort of character? This piece by Dunn very explicitly is casting. In fact, its entire purpose, from the first line about the world to the body, all the way to the end of the end, the physician is sent for, is about, I'm trying to cast the physician a certain way. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to build myself up and build up the character of the physician so that I can enter this clinical encounter a certain way. I want to start there because what we're going to move to now is Arthur Frank talking about the wounded storyteller, because now we're talking about a shift. Dunn is wounded when he writes that piece, when he writes that meditation, but he's not yet a patient. He hasn't yet had that clinical encounter. So there's absolutely an, if not optimistic perception of the physician, it's at least a hopeful perspective of the physician, because that encounter hasn't happened yet. But Frank is having us now thinking about writing those narratives in the encounter when we're wounded. And in particular, and remember this when we talked about Dunn into the next narratives, with both Dully and with both White, and they're talking about their encounters, my lobotomy and my therapists, it's a physician had been sent for. It's after the fact. And now how can I evaluate that situation and that physician so healing can happen? Dunn is writing to evaluate the physician so he can hopefully has a good healing encounter in the future. Dully and White are doing it after the fact so they can almost heal a bit what happened in the past. Having said that, let's take a look at Arthur Frank for a second and look at some of what he gives us as a bit of a playbook for how to think about wounded narratives. Let's start on page 53. Now, Frank starts by giving us two ways, and here he's quoting Judith Sirucz's book, in which he says that what stories do. Being seriously ill call for stories in at least two senses, he said. Now, the first of these is at the end of the first paragraph after this thing that says narrative wreckage, right? Stories have to repair the damage that illness has done to the ill person's sense of where she is in life and where she may be going. Stories are a way of redrawing maps and refinding new destinations. Secondly, and this is in the next paragraph, the second sentence, stories of the illness have to be told to medical workers, health bureaucrats, employers, and work associates, family and friends. Whether ill people want to tell stories or not, illness calls for stories. So the two examples we might have then here might be described as one, stories, as he says, repair, although we might also say map, because it seems to be he likes that metaphor of the map. Stories give trajectory. They make sense of. They give a lay of the land if the clinical experience
And secondly, when he talks about medical workers and bureaucrats and employers and all that sort of shit, he's talking about stories have to relate information. So, in other words, according to this breakdown, this is the most basic of dualities, if you will, two-part breakdowns here. Stories have a practical function in the level with which they relate information, and stories have a non-practical, and I use the word non-practical because it's as big as can be. Basically, they do one thing and they do everything that's not the other. A non-practical function, which is to say they give us emotional center. They give us a sense of which end is up, if you will, to some degree. They allow us to understand. They allow us to remember. They give us a sense of purpose. They give us a sense of value or understanding or appreciation of encounter. So the practical and the impractical might be a better way, I think. Frank could have said this here at the beginning, for what stories need to do. And I just say that to make explicit what are ways in which we need to address the stories that happen and the stories that we read. If I can get you to turn to the next page, to page 54. There's a couple moments here on page 54 that I want us to look at where Frank is talking about basically not just caveats, but key features and markers that speak to stories. And by the way, when we get to Walter Benjamin, I'm much bigger of a Walter Benjamin fan than I am a Frank fan. Not that I don't like Frank, but I think Frank is giving us his sort of like a bit of a, this is how I see the field and how I see reading. And it's a very sort of like, you know, here's a stab in the dark sort of way to think about different kinds of, which is to say that for me and for all of us, we can totally be like, that's a really good point, Frank, or that's stupid, Frank, I don't agree with you. We're totally fine with doing that. Don't think this is word is God, so to speak. On pages 54 and 55 in particular, then, he's giving us a few more lines to how to think about doing storytelling with the wounded. This is on page 54. It's in the middle of the page, and it starts in the third paragraph. The repair begins by taking stock of what survives the storm. Now, Frank, as I said, loves thinking about the mapping that storytelling does, but he also loves this metaphor of geography, because suddenly we're hearing about the wreckage and the mapping and the ship and we're at sea and the story helps us and all the stuff, which is good. It works. But at the same time, like, get me off this boat. I need a Dramamine, right? This is going to be too much. So by page 55, though, he gives us to a practical example that I like. And this is the first full paragraph on page 55. My friend was also a narrative wreck because he, like anyone facing serious illness, had suddenly lost the central resource that any storyteller depends on. And this is, I think, a good point that he raises, a sense of temporality. The conventional expectation of any narrative, held alike by listeners and storytellers, is for a past that leads into a present that sets in place a foreseeable future. The illness story is wrecked because its present is not what the past was supposed to lead up to, and the future is scarcely thinkable. Skipping to the next paragraph, after the next one, the way out of the narrative wreckage is telling stories, specifically those stories that Schaeffer calls self-stories. Now, this term self-stories I find a bit strange in the sense that it sort of avoids, or we're talking about memoir, autobiography, or what have you, but I think it's supposed to be a catch-all. So let's just make that clear, that when we hear self-stories in here, we just sort of mean the whole shebang, if you will, to some degree. But it's the paragraph that I read just before that I really like, where he talks about the importance of a sense of temporality. Does anybody have any thoughts on why temporality or a sense of time is so important to storytelling and so complicated by sickness, based on what we just read or in general?
Well, kind of reminds me of that storytelling arc we were talking about last week with the, you know, the normal kind of bell curve
looking
thing versus the plateau, and
right.
Illness sort of disrupts our expectations that things follow that nice, happy,
absolutely,
lovely curve that we all remember from grade school.
I'm going to draw on the board just to get so everybody knows what we're talking about, because I think when we're talking about temporality, we're talking about a couple of different things time-wise. Yeah, this stinks. Okay. So we had our curve, right? Everybody remembers this, thinking about exposition and resolution, and we talked about chronicity being slightly different than how we think about that particular thing. But when we think about temporality, then, give me some words to say what we're thinking about, because I really do think it might be the best thing that's in the Frank world. What are some things we think about when we think about temporality? We think about when something happened. What else?
How it happened.
Right. How long it happened.
How
again.
Long it's going on to go on for.
Good. Future. Will it continue to some degree? What other time contributing factors we think about in storytelling?
What caused it over the antecedents?
Before. Good. After, which is to say that temporality is almost always associated too with chronology, right? And what sequence of particular things happen to some degree. What else?
Yep. Age of occurrence.
Good. Old, how old? How also it leads to us thinking about temporality almost always leads to us thinking about mortality, too, right? The ending of a story. Does the ending of telling the story have to be the end of the life at the same time, too? I mention all of these things not to just sort of riff on the complexities of time and storytelling, but to say that they absolutely are significant contributing factors, if you will, to how illness stories are difficult. Now, Frank's theory is this. It's that the problem of temporality is so central to illness narratives, more so than just narratives in general, because illness is the thing that fucks up what we thought our temporality was in life. What we thought our future would be, what we thought our life would look like, we know that one can get ill, but that's not the thing that we normally plan for. So illness comes into the picture, comes into our lives in most cases, at a time when it's changed what we thought about when something would happen, how long, what my future would look like, how old will I be, how long will I live. Illness is a thing that threatens the time of our lives, and by that extension, then, the story that is our lives. Think about it this way. There is a need, then, for storytelling of illness, literal storytelling of illness, because the truth of the matter is that illness does not prompt us to tell a story about our lives. The truth of the matter is, whether we take pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, throughout our lives, as we're planning our futures and remembering our pasts and living our present days, we're telling a story about ourselves. What did my yesterday look like? What do I want my today to be like? And what do I want tomorrow to be like? Just the thought of that, the rumination on it, and the planning in the future is its own kind of composition, its own kind of storytelling. Illness comes in and it screws that up to some degree. Mm-hmm. It changes that. Therefore, what it actually does is take the storytelling we already do up here in our lives, and some of us who are good at journals, I'm shitty at it, but those of us who are good at it do it already every day when we write things down. But illness prompts us to that much more, take up the pen or take fingers to keyboard, because now we need to figure out a way. And it does it because of those two reasons, because practically we have to, and impractically we need to some degree. So storytelling becomes the thing at a moment of illness that doesn't add a new function to our lives, the way we think about our lives. It just sort of kicks it up a notch to some degree. Let's turn, if you will, to just maybe one or two more passages here. Turn to page, well, this is 56. I'll give you an example of how Frank describes this in his section called Interruption and Purpose. In the beginning is an interruption. Disease interrupts a life, and illness then means living with perpetual interruption. To that degree, then, I like this, especially the second half of that sentence, because it embraces the fact that there are certainly people who know they are sick or who have a chronic illness or who plan their lives around being sick. But if the initial news of that illness is an interruption, the reminder of it and the planning around it is just like, as he says here, a perpetual interruption to some degree. To that degree, then, how we think about illness and how we write about it, according to Frank, to some degree, is a way for us to also kind of take the interruption out of the interruption, if you will. It's to integrate the illness into our narrative story. So in other words, if my narrative story of my life was supposed to be, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to meet somebody really nice, we're going to have kids, we're going to have a house, we're going to get married, blah, 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 and then I get sick, obviously, and this is what we do when we get sick, we try to think, what can I do to manage that sickness without losing anything that I had planned before? I still want to go to college, I still want to get married, I still want to have kids. Narrative does is take that interruption and doesn't just heal and preserve what we wanted, it integrates, I think, the illness into our lives and into our story to some degree. So if our responsibility is to try to think about how to not just heal from an illness and not just preserve the things we have planned for our lives, storytelling is about making those things fuse together. And we see this most often, I think, in cases where we're talking about people who are saying, talking about AIDS activists or breast cancer survivors or what have you. People who take that illness and the story of it and the harshness of it, but really own it, and therefore almost have a not just sense of pride about it, but really make that a core component in terms of how they tell their life story to some degree. Let's look at one more moment. This is on page 63. Do you have any questions so far? I know I'm talking a lot, but... Okay. This is page 63. The last full paragraph on this page. What makes an illness story good is the act of witness that says, implicitly or explicitly, I will tell you what you want to hear, but I want what I want to, I will tell you what you want to hear, but what I know to be true because I have lived it. This truth will trouble you, but in the end you cannot be free without it, because you know it already. Your body knows it already. In telling this story truthfully, the ill person rises to the occasion.
What do we make of this? This is what Frank says in Illness Story says, and I'm going to read it again. This is that long quote, right? He sets it up as though it sounds like it's going to be just a short euphemism. Like, an Illness Story basically says, here I am, or this is as it is, but instead it's this very long phrase that I want us to just take a few minutes to discuss. That is this what we think Illness Stories do? Is this what we think Illness Stories have to do? Is this what we think Illness Stories sometimes do? Or none of those things? And the truth of the matter is, I don't know what the answer is, but it seems to me a rather bold claim to make, especially in combination with what Frank ruminates on here, which is the truths of things, which is, again, another bold thing to stake on. But let me read it again. He says basically that Illness Stories implicitly or explicitly provide the following. I will tell you not what you want to hear, but what I know to be true because I have lived it. This truth will trouble you, but in the end you cannot be free without it because you know it already. Your body knows it already.
Reality.
Good. So part of it is just like, I got to tell you the harsh truth. It's got to lay it out for you. And even if it's going to be hard, you need to hear it. So, and whether that says to say that it's hard for you to hear it or hard for me to tell it, truth has to be told. Good. I think that's a good way to take Frank. But what else is Frank implying here? Yeah.
I think he might be saying that in part Illness Stories have a special capacity not to move or touch because no matter how different we all think we are from each other, yeah, we have this body that we're all capable of that function in very similar ways.
Yeah.
You can't get away from that.
Absolutely. So I love the fact then that what we have then here is stories that have the capacity to move. But Frank also, and I really am sort of lingering on this statement that Frank gives because he's so definitive about this is what Illness Stories do. But also he sets the bar rather high, I think, you know, which is to say, I'm going to tell you something and you're not going to like it here. And it's really going to upset you. And it's going to change the way you live your life. But you need to hear it. And then, oh my God, get ready. Here comes the story, right? Because this is totally over. Then the story comes and like, well, hey, it's not that big a story, right? You know what I mean? Like, I think that there's a way in which Frank here is talking about the most profound scenario, if you will, with an Illness Story. But I don't know that all Illness Stories have to move people that much, that all Illness Stories have to trouble you in the end, that all stories have to stir within you what your body already knows, you know? That seems a lot to ask of Illness Stories, I think, you know? Yeah.
I also don't know that they all have to be completely true. Like, I think there's some element of denial and hope in Illness Stories. So the fact that they have to be true and that you cannot be free without it, I think sometimes it may be just as freeing to be in denial. Not that that will change things, but
yeah.
I don't think it has to be all true.
I think Frank has a great thing here, and this absolutely is about this idea that, like, a story that really just sort of does the hard work of telling the story and lingering on the hard details absolutely does the work it needs to do. But that use of the word truths is really difficult because, of course, in a clinical mm-hmm. encounter and in any encounter in life, that notion of trueness or truth is almost an elusive thing. So that is to say that a clinician and a patient can be in a room together and they can both leave the room and tell their story. And those stories can be totally different, mm-hmm. but they feel the truth to them. Now, I think Frank in his heart of hearts actually means that what you feel is the truth is kind of what he means when he says truths. But I think what really needs to be here is a better term to use than truth might be authenticity.
Yeah.
What feels most authentic mm-hmm. for you for when you're telling a story? The truth is the elusive thing that we will never reach. The truth is a combination of what the doctor said in the room, what I said in the room, what the nurse said in the room, what my caregiver said in the room, and what the surveillance camera recorded in the room. And somewhere in between is the truth. Even the camera probably doesn't get the whole truth, right? But what feels authentic to each of these voices in each of these moments, I think that's the core thing. Now, the authenticity of that, though, is the fact that I don't think it always has to be so troubling, as this story says. And in fact, troubling, I think, is not the onus on storytellers or on listeners or witnesses in these encounters. Rather, as authentically as you tell that story, I will equally authentically try to hear it and try to get as close as I can towards registering and understand it. Now, does that mean I could be troubled by it? Absolutely. Does that mean I can be brought to tears? Absolutely. Does that mean I can be bored to tears? Absolutely. Any of those things, right? The quality of the story, the authenticity of the story, its truth, if you will, so to speak, is not how moving it has to be, which is what Frank almost says here. I think that's a lot to ask of sick people, right? It's just about how authentic it feels, I think, in comparison to what the person who's telling that story is. To that end, Illness Stories, and as we'll find in this class, and I have a big belief that narrative studies in medicine isn't just about reading people's short stories or memoirs or what have you about medical encounters, but how stories are used in clinical practice. Most of the stories are boring, aren't they? you go to somebody's therapy session, right, and you're not the person who's in the chair telling your story, oh my God, you're like, when is this 50 minutes up? This is so boring. If I have to hear about Karen one more time, you know, it's that kind of stuff, right? Or if you had to read stories about people, doctors, when they write down their case reports or their histories, or they had to read up their write, so boring. If you had to read psych consult write-ups, a lot of those are kind of dull too, because they have to be factual and such. The majority of medical narratives, in truth, I think, are not troubling or are not particularly compelling. But narratives they are, and valuable they are, and authentic they also have to be. The authenticity might be a little bit different. The register might not be just emotional, but they absolutely need to be there. So I linger on this Frank moment because I think he raises all of the right things, but I'm recasting them a bit, so they seem a bit different, if you will. Let's turn to My Lobotomy, then, by Howard Dully. Any questions or any comments? I know we're moving at a breakneck pace today, but we're not normally going to have this kind of pace, but it's good for us today because we're kind of laying discussions about all of the readings for today, but we're just laying the groundwork for the weeks to hear on out. All right, so My Lobotomy by Howard Dully. Is everybody familiar with what a lobotomy is? Does somebody want to tell us a couple sentences on what a lobotomy is? I mean, there's a bit of a description of it in here.
Good description, isn't it?
It's detailed. Yeah, it's detailed, right? Lobotomy is a procedure. It's a neurosurgery. It's a procedure, and it's done to perform in order to sort of control neurological or psychological problems. It was first done by Italian doctors in the middle of the 20th century, and in particular as a way to control mania and to control schizophrenia. And the procedure basically, as we'll come to find, is basically about taking an instrument, which basically looks like a pick of some kind, and above the eye, inserting it here and basically performing some kind of physical trauma to the frontal lobe of the brain. The belief being then that there is already some kind of psychological trauma that the brain already has in it that has caused or manifested itself in this kind of schizophrenia or manicness. And therefore, we can counter out that psychological trauma by actually physically impairing the brain. Which is to say that the innovation of this procedure was supposed to be that the way it corrects an injury to the brain is by injuring the brain, if you will, to some degree. Now, this procedure was very popular for a very short period of time, mostly in the 1950s and 1960s. It was largely performed, as I said, in Europe, in Italy, was where it really took off. And in fact, the man who first innovated it was given the Nobel Prize in Medicine at one point. And Howard, and then Dr. Walter Freeman, who we have here in America, was the one who first discovered this procedure abroad, brought it to the States, renamed it lobotomy, and just went like wildfire and did thousands of lobotomies within a number of years. And the reason being that he really thought it was going to be the panacea, if you will, that would solve all kinds of psychological and psychiatric sort of problems, if you will, to some degree. To that end, the procedure's problem was the fact that, of course, that it was supposed to be the quick fix, if you will. It was supposed to be the simple procedure, do the thing, have it done, and that's supposed to solve the problem. Its actual justification and its actual solution was the fact that lobotomy never actually erased or took away from or jettisoned the actual psychological problems that were there. What it did was it almost sedated them and almost muted them to some degree. So the solution that was supposed to come from a lobotomy was that it was supposed to take the unmanageable mind, the unmanageable person, and render them manageable, if you will, to some degree. Now, I love this memoir that we have here by Howard Dully because of the fact that what it does is it asks us to consider absolutely the procedure, as it's called, My Lobotomy. It asks us to consider the life of this particular man who went through lobotomy and asks us to consider the legacy, if you will, of this particular physician whose career was attached to it. Just to give you a heads up, the lobotomy procedure, as I said, proliferated for about 10 years or 12 years or so, and then, of course, faded away because of the fact that it was proven to have very little success rate. In fact, the problem with lobotomy was the fact that Freeman would go around touting its success rates, but what constituted success was absolutely debatable. So a person might have erratic visions or something like that, and they went to see Walter Freeman, and they would have a lobotomy, and the erratic vision would go away. Well, they all, and they would be like, success story! And it turns out the person, if you look, dug a dig deeper, well, also they lost the ability to talk, and they can no longer communicate, and they're left in a comatose state. But the erratic visions went away, so this is how he, in many ways, sort of manipulated, if you will, the stats for what he did. To that end, we're privy to something privileged here because of the Dully memoir providing for us somebody who lived a long life, a full life, a sad one, if you will, after having a lobotomy, but one who has the rare perspective, which to say, what are the long-term effects? The long-term memories and the long-term temporality, time, if you will, of thinking about what a lobotomy does and means. I want to start with the preface, and I'm going to read it and have us read it in full here, because I kind of love the way that the preface really starts. It's succinct, but it provides for us the exact blueprint and playbook that he's going to be using throughout the rest of this book. So I will start, and I'm going to read just the first couple of paragraphs here, and would you take for me and continue to read, and then we'll move down the table until we get to the end of the preface. This is the preface for My Lobotomy. My name is Howard Dully. I'm a bus driver. I'm a husband and a father and a grandfather. I'm into doo-wop music, travel, and photography. I'm also a survivor. In 1960, when I was 12 years old, I was given a transorbital or ice pick lobotomy.
Okay. My stepmother arranged it. My father agreed to it. Dr. Walter Freeman, the father of the American lobotomy, told me he was going to do some tests. It took 10 minutes and cost $200. The surgery damaged me in many ways, but it didn't fix me or turn me into a robot, so my family put me into an institution.
I spent the next 4 decades in and out of insane asylums, jails, and halfway houses. I was homeless, alcoholic, and drug addicted. I was lost. I knew I wasn't crazy, but I knew something was wrong with me. Was it the lobotomy? Was it something else? I hadn't been a bad kid. I hadn't ever hurt anyone. Or had I? Was there something I had done and forgotten? Something so horrible that I deserved a lobotomy.
I asked myself that question for more than 40 years. I thought about my lobotomy all the time, but I never talked about it. It was my terrible secret. What had been so wrong with me?
In 1998, when I was 50, things changed. I had suffered a heart attack. I had married a woman I really loved. I had gotten clean and sober and gone back to school and earned a degree. People who met me didn't know I'd had a lobotomy. I spent 10 years in mental hospitals. They met a big man. I'm 6'7" and 330 pounds, with a big mustache and a big laugh, whose job was driving special education kids to school on a yellow school bus.
They didn't see the man who was tormented by a shadowy past. Then Dr. Freeman died. My stepmother died. My dad and I had never talked about the past, and now he was in poor health, too. I was afraid that all the people who really knew what had happened to me would soon be gone.
So I decided to try to find out what had been done to me. I sat down in front of my computer, logged onto the internet, and typed in the words, Dr. Walter Freeman.
So it began a journey that 4 years later brought me to Washington, D.C. I had met a pair of radio producers who were doing a program on lobotomy for NPR. They had arranged permission for me to see Dr. Walter Freeman's lobotomy archive. Even though Freeman personally lobotomized more than 5,000 patients, he paved the way for the lobotomy of tens of thousands more. I was the first one in history to show up asking to see his files.
The archive is handed me a manila folder on the front of it for the words Dully Howard. The great mystery of my life was inside. The question that had haunted me for more than 40 years was about to be answered.
Great. I love this introduction because it really does, as I said, lay out the framework for the book, but it really sets up what I think this book does. And having read even just the chapter that I gave you called My Lobotomy, this book is about a man writing his own story in combination with reading his own story, right? He's reading the doctor's file at the same time he's now trying to work out that memory and that experience of what happened as he's writing this particular memoir. And that's why this book actually ends up then being 5 paragraphs that he's written, and then a paragraph from Walter Freeman's notes, and then something he's written, which is to say that as much as it is, we think about illness narratives and self-stories, if we want to use frank terms, as being monologues or soliloquies or testimonials that people give, but sometimes they're dialogues, and I think this book is a dialogue. It's a conversation that's happening between the story that I'm telling now about what I experienced and the story with what's inside that medical record that said what happened to me. Thus, the preface sets up, here's who I am, here's what happened to me. I Googled Dr. Freeman, I found my file, and literally, sort of the memoir begins at the end of the preface with the guy with the file folder in hand with, okay, here we go. If the done thing, the done piece that we read is on the precipice of meeting the physician, all right, he's on his way. This is, I have the file in front of me, I'm gonna borrow your folder. Okay, this is, I have the file of my case in front of me, and the preface is, all right, let's start. And you turn the page and it's chapter 1. I open the folder, so to speak, and that's where it starts. So, and ironically, what we have here then is a story that is about reading, if you will, to some degree. And that reading is about reading a story of yourself, a medical history, a medical story, but that prompts remembering, which really creates the book itself, if you will, to some degree. And the truth of the matter is I don't think that's just unique to this memoir, to this My Lobotomy, to Howard Dully. In fact, I think it might be a contributing factor to almost all of the medical narratives, in particular the self stories, if you will, that we're going to read this semester. What did you make, first of all, of the tone of the speaker, the narrator, Dully, in this preface, looking just at the first couple of paragraphs? Because part of the job of a preface, by the way, in any book you read, if you want to know, is absolutely to set up. It's different than an introduction. A preface's job is to set for you the tone for how it is to get ready to read this book. Sometimes it's to tell you just a few facts you need to know before you get in there. Before you start reading, you think you need to know that blah, 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 and this is where the research was done, and yada, yada, yada. But in other cases, it's just to give you that little bit of a, not an appetizer, that's your introduction. But everybody knows that, those of you who watch Food Network or Top Chef or whatever, a amuse-bouche, right? That's what the preface is. The preface is that just one taste. But that taste is supposed to give you a sense about what's to come. So what's the taste you get here of Freeman's voice, what he sounds like, what kind of guy he is? Yeah.
Very simple and plain.
Plain spoken, straightforward, you know.
But with lots of different roles and identities that he's able to figure out.
He's a full person, mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, this is the important thing. The book is called My Lobotomy, but this is about having to help us understand, help him integrate what happened to him with his lobotomy, but to reconcile that with the other parts of his life, too. The lobotomy was something that had happened to him, but it's not the only thing that defines him. So the introduction is very, and this is literally, it's almost to the point where you expect there's almost a hand being extended to you. My name is Howard Dully, I'm a bus driver, I got kids, grandkids, I like doo-wop music, you know, long walks on the beaches, fine dining, you expect it to be that kind of description, right, where it's the setup for sort of what his profile is, right? But the irony is here the fact that it's all done very casually, it's all done very nonchalantly, it's almost done in a very kind of like, sort of, you know, nonplussed sort of way. But so too is the fact that he has a lobotomy, right? I have doo-wop, I have grandkids, I drive a bus, and in 1960, I had a nice pick shoved into my head and had a lobotomy.
That's why he's that way, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why, there's a reason. So
this is what we're left to wonder. This is what we're left to wonder in this voice. Absolutely, great point. It's the fact that the simplicity, the plainness of speech here, is this an artifact or a remnant of his personality? Is this just who the guy is, or is this what lobotomy does?
I wonder that, and also, is it just such a serious topic, and he's so personal with it, that he's trying to convince us he's being as objective as possible?
Absolutely. And we get no clear answer. And this is what narratives in general about illness do. We always have to wonder, mm-hmm. especially psychiatric ones or ones that are related to neurological conditions, how much of what I'm reading is the emotional experience of this person, how much is it the psychological? In this case, the testimonial itself, my lobotomy, is supposed to be a narrative that allows healing for the lobotomy that happened. It allows a witness. It allows a testimonial about the procedure and about how we need to know that these kind of things happens. But it's also kind of evidentiary of, and I'll tell you, I survived that lobotomy because I can talk and I can write a book and I can still sound like an intelligent person is part of what it's there for. Which is interesting then because it sets for us a really difficult task as readers, the witnesses, as Frank says. We want to hear the authenticity of that story. We want to trust everything that we're hearing. But we're almost doing a psych eval, I think, the entire time we're reading this book. Mm-hmm. At least I think I am, right? I'm always trying to wonder, like, wow, he put that really simply and plainly. That was really, like, you know, generous or not bold of him or something like that. But other times I'm like, aw, stupid lobotomy, you know? Like, I don't know. It's hard to tell, right? It's hard to tell. And I think we get the sense, absolutely, at least at the level of personality, that this guy is just an easygoing guy. I drive a bus. I got kids. I like doo-wop music. You know, I'm just living my life. And especially when we hear about the fact that he's sober now and had to go through those, we realize that he's somebody who's definitely finding the graces in small things every day, right? Our hard part is knowing the tragedy and the trauma of the procedure he had and how much that has not just influenced the tragedies in his life, but affected the very voice he's providing for us in this particular moment. Yep.
I thought it was a tragic irony that he was born with the name Dully.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even think about it. Right. You know,
but also in answer to the question, which Frank's answer, I think, on page 101 at the bottom, he says, Freeman may have been trying to convince himself that I was all better. He was going to have a hard job convincing his medical colleagues. And I thought it was terribly insightful because neurosurgery at that point was in a dull lull. There wasn't anything great going on. You know, Harvey Cushing was in the past and MRIs had yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, neurosurgeons weren't doing anything very exciting. And he's come up with
Well, this is why lobotomy proliferated so fast, because it was very exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting in the fact that it appeared very heroic. It appeared minimally invasive, but it offered quick results and immediate results. One of the people that most famous patients of Dr. Freeman's was Kennedy, sister. She had a mild form of like mental impairment, developmentally disabled just slightly, but at the level of just a lot, not emotionally or intellectually mature as she should be, but also just a bit hard to manage, I think, in terms of emotional stability. But definitely not erratic or what have you. But Freeman sold to the Kennedy family this particular cure-all, if you will, and so a lobotomy was performed on her, and she went on to live like another 50 or 60 years, I think, but significantly mentally impaired as a result of the lobotomy to some degree. I like that they mention that example, though, in the sense that she's the most famous example of somebody who probably had undergone a lobotomy and had tragic results from it, barring fatality. But Dully's just an average everyday guy, and he's just a bus driver with kids and grandkids and lives someplace in Southern California or what have you. And it's the disparity between those kinds of lifestyles and the way in which the lobotomy procedure, I think of the way in which clinical procedures have the ability to touch all different kinds of lives. And it's those extremes and everything in between sort of speak to it. I also like what this lobotomy says here, and I think also in terms of some of the kinds of medical care we talk about, that what Dully talks about at the bottom of this first page of the preface is a lot about the, had I done something wrong, was I to blame, which is to say that I think a lot of the healing that happens at the level of something like a lobotomy, or I think any kind of medical procedure, in its long-term effects, is obviously how do you deal with the trauma of it, but how do you deal with also the shame of it, or the guilt of it, or the responsibility of it? Why did this certain experience happen? How am I going to deal with, accept, or get over the trauma or the shame? Because certainly we know you don't have to have a lobotomy to be shameful about a medical procedure. There's tons of people that are shameful about, and I say shameful not to scold them, but just to say that they're concerned about whether they're seropositive or whether they've had a mastectomy or whether they've had a sexually transmitted disease or something. Storytelling is one of those ways, I think, that repairs some of that shame. If we think about what the value of the story is, I think that's one of the ways and one of the features that it speaks to. And Dully just raises it right from the get-go here. So that, if we look now, the major moment that prompts this book, though, is this. He sets up for us the procedure that happened. He talks about the life he's lived, the wife he's had, the children he's had, the grandchildren, the job, getting on drugs and alcohol, sobering up. But none of those things prompts him the desire to write this book. What prompts him to write this book is what starts on the second page of the preface. They didn't see the man who was tormented by his shadowy past. This is, again, the shame that he's talking about. He hasn't told anybody about this. And this is the moment that decides he wants to write about this. Then Dr. Freeman died. My stepmother died. My dad and I had never talked about the past. Now he was in poor health too, aka he's about to die. I was afraid all the people who really knew what had happened to me would be gone soon. So how do these deaths then contribute, prompt the writing of this memoir, would you say?
I think he realizes he's damaged and he didn't want his story to go on.
Good. So, and which is ironic, because most times we think of somebody saying, I don't want my story to go untold because they're John Donne. I think I'm on my deathbed. All right, time to tell my story. I haven't got so much time left. But this is not about him being on his death door. It's the fact that Dr. Freeman died. It's about his stepmother died. It's about the fact that his father is sick and he might die and they don't talk about it. And the last chance is the fact that all the other people in the world who know about this condition, the witnesses who've been to it in the past, and even if they don't talk about it now, they're going to be gone. Which is to say, Dully fears or sees himself on the precipice then of not dying, like Dunn did, but he's on the precipice of living in a world where there's nobody else in the world who knows what happened to me. And that's too much to bear. That's too much of a burden. So part of the purpose of these stories then is to unload, right? When we tell the story about our illness or our narrative or the trauma that we experienced, we're not getting rid of it entirely, but we're giving ourselves, the storyteller, the comfort in knowing that there's somebody else out there who knows what has happened to me. And this is what Dully is fearing, because with his stepmom dying and with Dr. Freeman being dead, and now with his father being on death's door, I guess, it's the fear that I can't carry it just myself.
I think that, I mean, because he already worries about the issue of unreliability, so the fact that he's actually worrying about people dying again, you know, might mean that he's scared of the fact that no one's actually going to believe him. I mean, is that some sort of closure for it?
I think so. I think even the fact that he's not waiting for his father to die to write this, it's almost that while there's still one more witness to corroborate what I'm about to say, it's still here. I want to tell this story. Yeah.
Well, and I also think there's kind of the underlying theme that he is not particularly witness to his own story.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just always hanging out there for him. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think there's something to be said for actually saying the things out loud or writing them down and actually going through that process to yourself, by yourself. And if you really don't have all those pieces, it would be very frightening to not be able to get through that process before
yeah.
people are left.
And I think that's why it's a combination of needing to have witnesses and needing to tell that story with also having the medical record with him. I think the combination of the two provides both the formula for how this book is executed, but I think also the exact moment of when its composition particularly happens. Yeah.
It also sounds like he finally gave himself the permission to do that.
Mm-hmm.
With stepmother still around for
that. Well.
Even with maybe the doctor, and with the father about to be lost, there was no witness.
Well, which is to say then that there's a reason he's telling this story now, and there's a reason he didn't tell it before.
Right.
And why he didn't tell it before was either because of didn't have permission, or it was because as shitty as what happened to me was, I know there's somebody out there who knows what happens and they feel shitty about it too. Now there's nobody that feels shitty about it. Which is not, he's not asking us to bear the burden of that shittiness, but he's asking for something else, you know, which is to be heard. Yeah.
Well, also that despite its plain spokenness, it also sets it up as really a dramatic story because the Freeman and stepmother really are villains of the story. And so I thought there was an element of liberation, too, upon their deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And now
right.
Yeah, which is, in some ways, the silence that may have happened on the storytelling before might have just been their very, it sounds harsh, but existence, presence, if you will, to some degree, which is to say that I'm now living in a world where they won't hear this story as it's told out loud, and suddenly it feels a bit safer, maybe, to tell the story. Might explain some of its chronicity there. Looking then at the bottom, I love the fact that when the folder comes up and the case comes up, because of the fact that it really does set up then not just the testimonial aspect of this particular piece, but it's almost archival sort of nature in the way that it works with the doctor's work. Let's look at chapter 7. I want us to read, we're going to read at length here from the beginning of chapter 7.
Do the earlier chapters in the book go into more of his, what led up to this?
They do, and they talk about his life and what it was like and his parents and his stepmother, how they didn't get along. And by all means, the best way to describe Dully as a child would have been to say that he was at times unruly, right? Which is to say that he could have been temperamental or he could have been, like, you know, scolded or what have you. But he's a kid. But he wasn't particularly out there, if you will, to some degree, or totally unmanageable. Having said that, we're also living in an era here, let's not forget also too, where this is a child that's coming from a broken family, a broken marriage, right, too, who's probably grappling with also the distances between him and a stepmother and split homes and that sort of thing, but at a time when divorce isn't as common. And yet, what happens is the unruliness of this kid combined with the divorce and the breakup in his family that's happening leads to the fact that maybe he needs to speak to a therapist or speak to a psychologist to control his behavior. Now, in this day and age, in a divorced household, that is like default position, right? Let's just make sure the kid's okay, what have you. At this time, having a child that needs to see a therapist, just see one, is already setting up, right? How is he? He seems a bit unruly. He saw a therapist, right? This kid's got psychological problems. So the leap from unruly to psychologically damaged is not that big of a leap at this particular time because it's very, very atypical for a child to need some kind of a psych consult at this particular time. So the fact that the circumstances are quite typical now for us for why a kid like Dully at his age would have needed to see a psychiatrist or a therapist or somebody to talk to, how a Walter Freeman or how a lobotomy at this particular time could have been seen as a way to rectify a very, what has been called troubled kid, we can see how the groundwork is being laid here for this time. But those earlier chapters, what's most remarkable about them is we read them and we understand how it led to lobotomy because of those exact historical circumstances I talked about, but we read what kind of kid he is and we just, the sadness as we read how normal he really was, you know? And how sad it was that he had problems in his family and wasn't getting along with his stepmom, but this is not a kid that needs that kind of invasive sort of particular procedure. So the sadness in chapters 1 through 6 is how normal his childhood sounds, even if it wasn't perfect. Chapter 7 is where, holy shit, it gets not just gruesome, but suddenly it gets really, really tragic, if you will. What I want us to do is start on page 95, and we're going to read through to page 99. I know it's quite a few pages, but It's a good chunk of prose, and it's a nice, yeah.
There was nothing earlier to corroborate the schizophrenia since he was four?
The schizophrenia diagnosis was actually one that was applied almost in combination with the lobotomy procedure, which is to say Freeman's sort of, what you call it, MO, was the fact that we need to do this extreme procedure, so let's change what his condition is to something more extreme. So it might have been called temperamental or, you know, dissociative personality or something like that. Let's just cross that out and put schizophrenia, because that's what the insurance covers with lobotomy or something like that, you know? So let's start on page 96, and why don't we start, you want to start reading for us?
Okay.
On page 96, read a couple paragraphs, whatever you want, and then we'll just move down the table. Right there, yep.
Doctors General Hospital is a small private institution in San Jose. It looks more like a set of doctor's offices than a hospital. It's a long, low building, painted all white, with room for maybe 50 or 60 patients. I was admitted as one of them on the afternoon of Thursday, December 15, 1960.
My dad drove me down there. Lou stayed home. I don't remember saying goodbye to her, or to George or Brian. I do remember having a sense of adventure, of playing hooky. I got to go to the hospital and they didn't. They had to go to school. It was a sunny day, and my impressions of the hospital are all sunny ones. After we did the admitting paperwork, they put me in a bright yellow room. My dad said goodbye without making a big deal of it, and I was on my own.
I got undressed and put on the gown with the opening in the back, which felt kind of ridiculous. Just like I'd expected, there were nurses clucking over me. It was a private room, so I got to watch whatever I wanted on TV. But after a while, I was interrupted by the nurses, who said the doctors had to do some tests. They took some blood, they listened to my heart. Then I went down to another room where they took some x-rays of my chest and then my head. The radiologist noted that my skull was normal, my pineal was not visualized, whatever that means, but that the frontal sinuses were extremely small and poorly developed. They gave me the stamp of approval and sent me back to my room.
That's it? Those were the tests? Fine. I wasn't worried about a thing. I knew I wasn't sick. Nothing hurt. Plus, when dinner came, I did get Jell-O. It wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and the meal was a little skimpy, but no one shouted at me. No one made me go eat by myself in the other room. I got to watch TV and eat dinner at the same time. I went to bed that night feeling cheerful. I don't remember whether the nurses gave me anything to make me sleep. Was there a pill? Was there a shot? It seems like there would have been, but I don't remember it. I don't remember anything that happened next.
Freeman's admittance order, written on the stationery bearing his 15 Main Street address in Los Altos, said this: please admit to Doctor's Hospital Thursday, December 15 at 3 p.m. for transorbital lobotomy, December 16 at 1:30 p.m. His pre-op orders called for a complete blood count measuring the bleeding and clotting times, a urine analysis, an x-ray of my skull, and an electrocardiogram.
So far, so good. In a sense, maybe up and about until time for operation, regular diet. The breast is certainly given sodium amytal at 10:30. Sodium amytal is barbiturate. It would certainly stay. That makes sense, too. But Freeman had a warning diagnosis. The boy is hurt. The patient is full of tricks. Nurse not to leave him alone at any time. He's not to know why he's in the hospital if he suffers from an
escape? Why would I try to escape? Where would I go? I was a 12-year-old kid in the hospital gown. My father and stepmother and doctor had all told me I was in the hospital for tests. I had no reason to believe they were lying to me. They were treating me like the birdman at Alcatraz, but I was just a kid who had been looking forward to Jell-O. I don't remember waking up the next morning. I don't remember being prepared for surgery. I don't remember seeing Freeman. I don't remember anything of that morning. That whole Friday disappeared. Then it was over.
I remember waking up the next day, which would have been Saturday. I felt bad. My head hurt. I had a fever. They kept taking blood and giving me shots. I thought something had gone wrong. What happened at the test? Freeman's notes tell the story. Howard entered Doctor's Hospital on the 15th, and yesterday I performed a transorbital lobotomy. The only thing that seemed to bother Howard was the needles he received on several occasions.
Freeman was assisted in the operating room by Dr. Robert Lichtenstein. His notes on the procedure sounded almost like a carpentry project. I introduced the Orbita class, the name Freeman had given his personal design lobotomy knives, under the eyelids 3 centimeters from the midline, aimed them parallel with the nose, and drove them a depth of 5 centimeters. I pulled the handles laterally, returned them halfway, and drove them 2 centimeters deeper.
Here I touched the handles over the nose, separated them 45 degrees, and elevated them. 50 degrees bringing them parallel for photography before removal.
In other words, he poked these knitting needles into my skull, through my eye sockets, and then swirled them around until he felt he had scrambled things up enough. Then he took a picture of me with the needles in, and that was that. To get me properly sedated, Freeman had administered a few jolts of electric shock. I don't know how much was typical, but I got some extra.
How it came around quickly after the first shot, Freeman wrote. I eventually gave him 4, after which he was quite slow in recovering. I think it was 1 more than necessary. After the procedure, Freeman wrote, there was an escape hook. A small amount of blood seemed to rip from the eye socket. I did not get much swelling this day. However, he did have a considerable amount of vomiting during the night, and I prescribed Dramamine 50 milligrams for its control. He'd been incontinent once during the night. He resisted efforts to get his eyes open and complained about the needles that were being given. His temperature, pulse, and respiration were quite normal.
My brain wasn't. Freeman said that I didn't know where I was or what was going on. When I saw him this morning, he recognized me but thought he was on Orange Street, and that the day was Monday instead of Saturday. He did not know that anything particular had happened to him. Well, I knew something had happened, because I felt terrible. I may have picked up some kind of infection. Freeman's next set of notes, written the following Wednesday, read, Howard had a rough time of it over the weekend. His temperature went up to 102.4 degrees. His neck was stiff. He had a severe headache and was quite sluggish. I did a spinal puncture, which showed some 4,000 white cells and 90,000 red cells, but the culture was sterile. During the waiting period for the culture, I had given him about five or six doses of penicillin, 1 million units each, and his temperature promptly came down and stayed down.
Freeman was sort of famous or infamous for that spinal puncture. Years before, he had developed something he called the Jiffy spinal tap. Though he was accused from the beginning of risking his patients' lives using it, he liked this procedure for the same reason he liked the transorbital product. It was quick and cheap and didn't require an operating room or an assisting physician. With his Jiffy procedure, Freeman simply had his patient sit in a chair, turn around backward, with his head bent forward and his chin resting on his hand. Freeman then punctured the spinal column with a needle and entered the spinal canal at the base of the skull, between the first vertebrae and the skull itself. As one medical writer said in his study of lobotomy, a slight error in this procedure can produce a life-threatening injury.
The spinal tap, the infection, the excess electroshock had left me pretty weak. Freeman's notes on my discharge read, he was a bit wobbly on his feet when he was discharged from the hospital, but was eating well, sleeping well, and had no complaint of headache. His neck had loosened up, and he seemed quite mild.
From reading Freeman's other notes, I know the procedure didn't last more than 10 minutes. There are no medical records available about my stay in Doctors General Hospital, so there is nothing but Freeman's notes to explain the fever and headaches and nausea.
But I do have a receipt, a physician's service report from Blue Cross Hospital Service of California. It says that I was admitted on December 15th to be treated for schizophrenia mixed and discharged on December 21st. Under the heading of medical treatment rendered, the paper says, transorbital lobotomy. A sharp instrument was thrust through the orbital roof on both sides and moved so as to sever the brain pathways in the frontal lobes. The charge for the hospital stay was $200.
Okay. I have us linger on this moment and look at it in length, not just because it's gruesome or what have you, or whatever, or sensationalistic or whatever, but rather because of the fact that I think it's probably really emblematic of how the use of detail is really used in this book in really important ways. What did you make of the kind of details that are invoked throughout this particular episode that we just read?
It's clear that he wrote this. It's clear that there was some, I don't think there's a lot of editing just by the words that are used in the phrasing. It's like these are his words.
And what gives you that feeling?
He says the paper says. I think if it was edited, it would say the paper reads.
Right.
So it's clear to me that these are his words.
Yeah, and I think also the kind of memories that we're getting, too, as well. The details that are standing out about the room being sunny or the food maybe being shitty or whatever else he's remembering, right? And I think this is sort of what it's important, then, is that we have textual evidence in the level of what Freeman wrote, what's quoted, what's italicized at length and quoted, the receipt that's invoked at the end, this kind of documentation. And by contrast, we have just the flashes, if you will, of memory that he has. Yeah.
I was going to say that's what makes it so gut-wrenching is really his innocence, and the details that he remembers are nothing at all compared to what's actually going on. And
yeah.
The contrast between what he's writing and the doctor's notes, which are, you know, just completely disconnected from that. It's really what makes it so...
Which is to say that the distinction between what the voice that we hear from Dully and the voice that we hear from mm-hmm. Freeman in the doctor's notes isn't just the one that's clinical and non-clinical, one that's procedural versus one that's personal. It's absolutely one that's just matter of fact about the procedure that has to be done, and one that's just innocent and unaware of what's coming before it. So the chasm between those two voices is rather great, which is to say that the authenticity, the truism, if you will, the truth that we're supposed to find, I think is a combination of these two. I mean, one of the great strengths of this book, I think, is that Dully absolutely recounts my lobotomy, but he also uses Freeman's notes too. And I think whether it's the choice of Dully or Charles Fleming, who helped write this, right, as a lot of memoirs are, they're co-written with someone, professional writer, you know, it's the idea that the true story here, the closest authentic story, might be some combination of what I remember, what happened, and what Freeman's notes say what happened. The sad fact also is the fact that what Dully is so frank about what he remembers, he reiterates again and again, I don't remember what happened that afternoon, I don't remember what time it was, I don't know where blah 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 was. Or he says on page 96, was there a pill? Was there a shot? That's it? Question mark. He's very frank about the holes, the gaps, about what he forgets. What we have then is a more, I think, ambitious and I think a more fair portrait of the lobotomy that combines Freeman's notes with his own testimonial. Together, they might be the real story. But we also know that without Freeman's notes, he feels like there can't even be that full story. So it's at once brave and sad at the same time that he needs those Freeman notes. I saw a couple hands up. Yep.
I think it's kind of interesting that he presents us Freeman's notes, but doesn't really explain that much. And I mean, for someone who would come at this without a clinical background, I mean, you wouldn't really know more than anyone else, like, what the spinal tap means or the electroshock. I mean, I don't think too many people know why they would do electroshock now. So it's like it kind of adds to our sense of confusion about what's going on, and it makes us more sympathetic.
Yeah, and I think it also shows that he's going to let Dr. Freeman's words speak for themselves. So as they're quoted, only in select moments does he give us a bit of a sort of like paraphrase, if you will, about a procedure. But I think, as you said, it absolutely does mirror then the, as Dully is writing about these procedures, if he had overheard them at the time as a young boy, what have you, he wouldn't have known what to make of them either. They wouldn't have been translated for him. Yeah.
I think the part in the beginning where he's talking about like how excited he is to be there eating dinner, because he's not going to yell at, he's not knowing it, like, really paints how, like, sane he is.
Yeah.
This little kid, he's not schizophrenic, gets pushed into the scenario.
No, and I think the almost routine way with which he's sort of reacting when he's been brought to the clinic for the procedure, and the way that he notices the gown seems sort of funny or what have you, and follows directions, absolutely, is a kind of way with it testifies to the fact that who allowed this procedure to happen in the face of what seems to be an otherwise rather obedient sort of kid.
I also think it's significant what isn't written. So he's not angry. He's not saying, can you believe they did this to me? It's not like he's like out for sympathy. He's just like, this is what happened.
The same. It's absolutely true. That same matter of factness that we had in the preface, I like doo-wop music, whatever, it's the same thing we get here. But again, given this story, it's the thing that makes us think he's brave that also makes us sad. We wonder, has this man been muted to some way because of what's happened to him?
See, I kept thinking the whole time how painful and enlightening his process of discovery must have been.
Yeah. So. And somehow he's rendering it to us in a way that's, either he's worked through it, so it doesn't seem like these are tear-stained pages that he's written to some degree, but they seem sort of processed or placid. Let's look, if you want, page 97. Two paragraphs I want us to look at very closely. And ironically, these are moments that reveal that very sort of like processed, sort of like calm sort of manner, but also actually speak to what you were talking about with the fact that the doctor's words speak for themselves and yet they're paraphrased for us. What we have here is on page 97, the italicized paragraph. This is the paragraph from Dr. Freeman's notes, that entire file that describes the procedure that happened to Dully. Not the procedures that happened in general, or how Freeman did procedures, or what happened before or after the prep, or afterwards to take care of the procedure, but what happened during the procedure. One paragraph, and we get the entire thing. What follows it is one paragraph that is two sentences that is Dully paraphrasing exactly what happened to him. So what we have then, and what I gave you to read, is this. We have a book called My Lobotomy.
reading chapter 7, which is my lobotomy. And now we are looking at the two paragraphs, the only two paragraphs that are about my lobotomy. Right? I mention this because the title is very strategic here. This is a book that's not called Lobotomy or The Lobotomy That I Went Under, blah, 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 or Me and Dr. Freeman, whatever. It's called My Lobotomy. Owning. I think this is a narrative about owning what happened. If there was shame before about the procedure, now it's about owning it. Literally, this possessive pronoun there, My Lobotomy. So the book is called My Lobotomy, right? Which is to say, it's also a salacious and catchy title, right? A book that's just called Lobotomy sounds like it might be like, you know, tragic, awful, you know, expose sort of thing, right? The one that's called My Lobotomy, where our interest is piqued as readers, because we're like, ooh, I wonder what the voice of somebody who had lobotomy sounds like, right? Mm-hmm. We're totally interested. So if we have the book in front of us, My Lobotomy, table of contents, ooh, chapter 7, My Lobotomy, turn to chapter 7, right? And then within chapter 7, these are the two paragraphs, which is to say that the book purports to be about my lobotomy, and it is, but there's really only two paragraphs, the entire book, that talk about the actual lobotomy that happened to this guy, which is to say there's something potent in those two paragraphs, but it also says that there's almost a way in which we aren't lingering on the procedure, but it's everything that surrounds the procedure that's what we're lingering on. So let's look at these two paragraphs, though. Let's take the bait on what the title of the book is and what the title of the chapter is, and let's look at these two chapters, which is why we picked up the book at the rack at the bookstore and wanted to buy it to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. This is what Freeman says. I introduced the orbitoclasts, and this parenthesis here is Freeman, providing some context, the name Freeman had given to his personally designed lobotomy knives, under the eyelids 3 centimeters from the midline, aimed them parallel with the nose, and drove them a depth of 5 centimeters. I pulled the handles laterally, returned them halfway, and drove them 2 centimeters deeper. Here I touched the handles over the nose, separated them 45 degrees, and elevated them 50 degrees, bringing them parallel for photography before removal. What do we make of this description?
It's very clinical.
Totally technical, totally routine. To be honest with you, I get the sense that he almost has this like a rubber stamp. Every time he goes and does the procedure, that's what he does. And truthfully, there was an absolute routine with which Freeman would go in, do the procedure, get the person set up, always took a photograph of everyone. All those thousands of procedures he did, he took a photograph of every single one, purportedly to be for the record, for technical purposes, what have you. But actually because of the fact, I think, that there was the sensationalistic aspect of the lobotomy did not go lost on Dr. Freeman himself. The man was a very accomplished, he's actually was trained at the University of Pennsylvania, that's where he went to med school. I know. I know, right? I think he'll go to Jeff instead, right? No. No. But he's a very trained, accomplished physician, but also at the same time had always been missing that magic bullet, that thing that was going to really make his career really take off. A very popular teacher and lecturer where he worked at, but always the person that was looking for the procedure, the kind of innovation that would really make his career really launch. And lobotomy was like the sort of really great sort of like thing for him for that. Having said that, then there's a kind of showmanship that's attached to Freeman that the photography element of the procedure really speaks to in some degree. Having said that, if we notice at the beginning of chapter 7, it also gives us a picture here of Dully when he also had that. Now, why that's important is because that seems to be very, as though it's almost objectifying and really rendering the patient as we see here. I mean, the two photographs that are put together here at the top of chapter 7 are the boy before the procedure, looking rather normal and sweet and innocent, and of course, him during the procedure where he's absolutely victimized, if you will, to some degree. And as tragic and as awful as that photography is, it's not unlike the storytelling that Freeman did in his case history. We read this paragraph that's italicized and it sounds equally gruesome, right? But you know what? Thank God for it, because it does provide testimony. It does provide a kind of corroboration, if you will, for what Dully needs to say. It provides the exact impetus for why Dully needs to tell his story, but also provides the corroboration. To that end, this idea that Frank says that all stories about illness need to be moving and profound and touch us or what have you, nope, because there's plenty of them that are horrific. And in fact, that photograph of that knitting needle in his eye, it's a story too, right? And it's a horrific one. But it also prompts the need for ones that are like what Dully has to give us here.
Yet there's no comment at all from Dully about what it was like to either look at the information that Freeman was writing or to look at the photos of himself having the procedure.
This is where the book is absolutely about him reconciling what happened to him. Not what happened to him when he had to read the folder of the information or look at the photograph, but what it had to be to use those tools, is what they were, the doctor's record, the photographs, all that, to help him understand the memory, the experience, if you will, to some degree. Truthfully, one would have thought that a memoir would have just been about all of it, and it could have been. But there's a very strategic sort of like methodology behind this book. It's why I had to start with that preface, because the preface really does set up, I know what happened to me, I know people who did know about it, I don't know everything about it, and now I have this documentation in front of me that's going to help me figure it out. So the book then becomes about, well, how do I make that story? How do I rewrite that story? Let's look at the second paragraph here. This is now where Dully rewrites basically what Freeman wrote. So Freeman's prose, as we said, rubber stamped, gruesome, technical, factual, you got it. And now Dully comes back with his colloquial, sort of normal man on the street sort of voice, but again here talking about, this is where, in the book My Lobotomy, the chapter My Lobotomy, this is the paragraph where he describes my lobotomy. He says, in other words, he poked these knitting needles into my skull, through my eye sockets, then swirled them around until he felt he had scrambled things up enough. Then he took a picture of me with the needles in, and that was that. What do you make of that? Of all the ways to describe what is the most central moment in this book, those are the two sentences he chooses to use. Why do you think he's even more colloquial than normal, I think? Right before, when he's talking about like doo-wop music or whatever, he just sounds like, eh, I'm a normal guy, I'm not pretentious. This sounds especially, yeah.
I think the word scrambled things up enough is rather profound for the way his life was for those next four decades.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's definitely emblematic about what happened in this small moment. What happens in these two sentences affects everything else that happens in his life. And the use of the verb scrambled or scrambled up is particularly important, as you said, for the way it speaks to not just what happened physically or somatically in that moment, but also because of the fact of all the terms to use. You know, he's not just going towards man on the street terms, you know. So if Dully's, if Freeman says, I went in and did some kind of move this way laterally in order to what have you, he could have said he inserted these knitting needles and then, you know, wiggled them around or moved them or whatever, but scrambled things up is particularly, you know, not just gruesome, but also colloquial, if you will, to some degree. So it takes the heat out, the register out of, and in fact, almost renders almost the exact precision that seems to be in what Freeman writes, it renders a kind of imprecision then in the way that how Dully rewrites it. Does somebody, yeah?
I think in kind of a touch on what you were saying earlier, I mean, if we are to take Dully as this kind of simple, straightforward kind of guy, by saying it in this kind of exaggerated language, he might be taking even more ownership of what happened. I mean, so if he can describe it in his own words,
yeah,
like he would say it to his friend or son or something.
And I'll tell you what else it is, too, in this moment. And you're exactly right. There's one thing I read in this paragraph that I really haven't read or don't read much else of the book, and that's anger.
Yeah,
it's
I think,
yeah.
I think because he was such succinct, brief verbiage of, he presents this magnificent thing that happened to him and how intense it was, and just is like, he stuck these in my head and scrambled my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And it's so impactful with the succinct amount of terminology he uses here that it strikes you even more so, and that, you know, and you wonder, is that all he has, or are those the only words he has for this,
right?
Or is he actually doing this to say,
I know,
yeah, I'm just a simple old guy, but he stuck these needles in my head and scrambled them.
He's a succinct guy throughout the book, but in this moment we feel like it's a different kind of succinctness.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel like it is on the one hand because he's still at a loss for words in some ways, as
mm-hmm.
he always is,
mm-hmm.
but here because we also feel like he's just biting his lip, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that, so to speak. Which is to say that the economy of this particular language right here, in the book throughout, but particularly in this moment, that's why I made that drawing about the book, lobotomy, and chapter, and to make the strategic decision to be so economical right here in the most salacious graphic part of it is the part that it almost denies us the dirty details that we would have picked up the book for to buy. But in denying us that, it actually hits us that much harder, I think. Mary?
You know, I really think they use the word poke. So non-scientific, if you look in the next paragraph, where it says properly sedated with coke, I mean, he's really saying this was not a medical, you know, so non-medical. So,
yeah. And it's actually a good word to use because that's basically what a lobotomy was. And I think the significance of the poke also suggests that what we're talking about here is lobotomy was fucked up because it didn't work. But lobotomy was mostly fucked up because someone thought that they could go in a matter of minutes with a simple poke and fix what could have been a large psychological or psychiatric sort of problem. It was the idea that there could have been some kind of that quick of a fix that was really the naivete of the public, of clinicians, of family members, of whomever, to think that procedure worked. And the brevity, I think, of the procedure here is strategic because it denies us what we want and it hurts us that much more. But I think because also then the lobotomy, as it's described in this book, It's just a poke in the book. It's just this much of a piece. And yet, how little this much can change a life, so to speak. So to linger on the lobotomy, to give us 6 and 7 and 9 pages of the procedure, would have ironically rendered too much time, too much airtime, if you will, to the lobotomy. Mm-hmm. Giving us a little bit of airtime of the lobotomy shows, shit, this book is 200 pages, and only 2 paragraphs describe the lobotomy, but it produced a 200-page book. And that's, I think you're exactly right to linger on the poke. Yep.
I also think he's trying to completely take any kind of credibility away from the physician. So he's saying, like, he used all these technical medical terms, but really all he did was just this simple, completely illogical procedure. And I also think that it's skillful how he writes about it so simply, because I think he's, like, I think that he is showing how not dulled he is, but, you know, how his mental capacity, like, he, you know, uses much more medical and big terms pretty comfortably throughout the chapter. And I think here it almost has the opposite effect on me. Like, I'm like, wow, he actually is a really powerful writer.
I'll give you an example, which is to say that every other moment we hear him talking simply or talking about himself, we're wondering if this is his personality or if this is the byproduct of the lobotomy or what have you. But here, I just think instinctively we know he could say a hell of a lot more. Which is to say that not only do I read anger in this paragraph more so than I do anywhere else, but I read savvy, if you will, more than I do anywhere else. Right? He's being very strategic here in what he's choosing not to say and what
Absolutely.
He's saying.
And I think if Freeman were reading this, he would go crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this clinician that's, you know, elevated this to this would go crazy reading that. It's not just scrambling, you know. I mean, it's a poke to him as well.
And I think even the way that we can render a kind of savvy here, which is to say that we can register an anger, so we're getting a lot of emotional resonance here that we're not getting elsewhere. We're registering a savvy, which is to say we can see there's a kind of an intelligent kind of strategy about choosing what to say or how to say. It also gives for us, I think, if there's a worry that we have, and I'll tell you this, reading all the chapters up to here, the sadness is we feel bad, because his life was very normal. And the sadness is the fact that this awful procedure had him. But the sadness is also we can't tell if, you know, is this the man who he once was, or has he changed, or is he a muted or a truncated personality, if you will, to some degree. I find this little paragraph to be a bit of a saving grace, because we can render in him, there's the person, you know, there's the attitude, there's a bit of the rebuke, if you will, to some degree. Mm-hmm. Yes?
This would have been the height of paternalism in medicine, 1920. I too was following anger and addiction. And I think what he does here in terms of scrambling things up and then on the next page, quotes the doctor, his temperature said it was normal, but my brain wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor says, no, he didn't know anything particular had happened to him. Well, something had happened.
Right.
And then finally at the bottom of that page, this must be the research he's done on Freeman. Because
what page are you on? I'm sorry, you've lost me.
98.
Uh-huh.
I actually don't think I deserve.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The jerkiness of the Freeman part is both the procedures that he does, but also the notes that he leaves behind, which is to say there's a way in which how we read the doctor's notes. You know, it's to say that the doctor has made this record because he's read the patient and written up this report. But how now we're rereading the doctor's notes is important. So I want to tell you this last thing here. If you look, sort of starting at page 104 through the end of the section, the amount of italicized prose really increases. So looking at 104, top of 105, 108, bottom of 108, top of 109, 111, and I'm totally 112, 113. I'm having us just skim this because this act of just skimming and seeing that we're really seeing here, you know, what is this dialogue? What is this communication between texts that's really significant? And that the personality then we get is ironically from the pen of Dully in terms of how he thinks about Freeman, so to speak, but it's from Freeman's own voice too. What I like that then is it suggests not just an ownership of what happened with my lobotomy, but also, to bring us back to the preface, an ownership of that case history, of that file, because what Dully has done that is not just owned the memory, he's almost usurped that case file, if you will, to some degree, by integrating it, by paraphrasing it, and by quoting it within his own memoir to some degree, which is to say that the ownership then isn't just of the procedure, the trauma, and the experience that happened, but of the case history itself, I think, in some way. And that seemed to me to be almost the ultimate kind of narrative coup, I think, that Dully performs here in this book. Let's move and look really briefly, if we will, at Walter Benjamin. I don't think we're going to have time to get to Edmund White today, but that's okay. Just keep it in your folder or in mind that next class I might want to talk a little bit about Edmund White. I want to look at just a couple of moments in Walter Benjamin. Now, have any of you read Benjamin before? He's largely a famous theorist, philosopher, and a literary scholar, writing largely at the turn of the century. Benjamin's work tends to be very sort of lofty and sort of philosophical, if you will. I mean, it's kind of great that we had the Frank reading earlier, because Frank is definitely writing from a, like, I'm a working guy, I'm a physician, do stuff, this is what I see with narratives or what have you, and Benjamin is much more of the, like, from the perspective of my professorial office, this is how I see storytelling working. And it's kind of nice to have a bit of both perspectives. Benjamin's storytelling rumination is based upon the works here of Nikolai Leskov, who's a famous short story writer. And what's happening here is Benjamin is thinking about the stakes of storytelling, of short story writing, in the wake of the rise of the novel, which happened in the 19th century, and in particular about how storytelling works in this day and age, where literacy is increasing, in this day and age being the 20th century, when literacy is increasing, printing culture and the dissemination of printed words is that much easier. But it also means that we're seeing the turning away from the disavowal of oral storytelling culture. So here Benjamin's concern is absolutely with storytelling at the level of as we tell a story out loud, but he means it absolutely in how we read. And his concern is, what's the difference between reading something, and he'll later talk about a novel, reading a novel and having that tell us something, versus reading a story. So what's a story, and what storytelling is what's important to him? Let's look at this first page. Page one, the very top, Roman numeral one. Familiar though his name may be to us, the storyteller in his living immediacy is by no means a present force. He has already become something more remote from us, and something that is getting even more distant. I mention this because the stakes with which Benjamin is writing is absolutely historical in terms of where print culture and literacy and storytelling versus novel writing and all that sort of shit and movies and all that stuff is happening. But it's absolutely trans-historical too. The stakes of how much do we value a storyteller. And always in the legacy of knowing, and I think Benjamin waxes a bit poetic and sentimental here about thinking about oral culture in the past, but I think he's right too, that storytelling used to be absolutely central to how knowledge was disseminated and to how values were confirmed and to how cultures were created. And this had everything to do, I think, with literacy. It had to do with the fact that a lot of people didn't know how to read, or there wasn't print culture, or there wasn't always paper, you know, if we're going way back in history. So how to tell a story was very, very important. And if we look at the long history, we see that there's less and less storytelling that's happening, or more importantly, that there's less value, if you will, on the need for storytelling. And it's just that legacy and burden, I think, that he wants us to remember. Looking at the second paragraph then, one reason for this phenomenon is obvious. Experience has fallen in value, and it looks as if it is continuing to fall into bottomlessness. Now this is important, this notion of the experience, the experiential. How experience can be a threat to storytelling, if you will. This is what he's going to get to in a second when he starts talking about reading and novels and things like that, because what he says is that people don't do as much, they just read about what other people do. The hard part is that storytelling necessitates sort of both of those things. And I think Benjamin's worry is the fact that it's not just the fact that we're going to be losing some kind of empirical knowledge, knowledge based on the experiences that we have, but that we're going to fail to see that storytelling can have its own kind of empirical sort of value. That, which is to say then, that storytelling, the act of hearing a story, is so important because of the fact that what it does is it provides its own experience, it provides its own kind of value. I want to explain more about that by looking at the next paragraph, Roman numeral 2. And this one we're going to read at length because it really lays out, I think, what Benjamin says storytelling is. Now, I say this because this article by Benjamin, by the way, is absolutely canonical throughout scholarship and anthropology and sociology and literary studies and narrative studies, so to speak. So a lot of the stuff we read this semester thinking about storytelling and narratives and bioethics and shit like that, if it doesn't reference Benjamin, it absolutely has in response to or in some ways tinged by what Benjamin says about storytelling. And the reason being that Benjamin just wants us to value stories. He's the first story advocate waving the flag, right? Value stories and think about how do we define stories, you know? And there are many different ways to do both of those things. That's really sort of the point. So looking at this paragraph on Roman numeral 2. Experience which is passed on from mouth to mouth is the source from which all storytellers have drawn. Think about that, okay, for a second. I'm already pausing here, but Benjamin's worry about storytelling and the worrying about reading and the way that it might impinge upon experience. Here he's taken that very word experience, and the experience is storytelling from mouth to mouth. And I want you to pay attention to then that what Benjamin wants us to pay attention to, and these are two words you might want to take note of. Storytelling is absolutely about two things, I think, for Benjamin.
The first is, I hope I'm spelling it right, reciprocity, right? And the second is dissemination. How do you spell dissemination? Dissemination, okay, good. Which is to say then, storytelling is falling away because the two most important features of it are the fact that we need to have reciprocity or reciprocal relationship then between listener and teller. I'm hearing you, you're telling me, we're connecting on this level. And the fact that that experience isn't going to be left to just those two parties, right? That it's not just the one person telling the story to the other, right? So in other words, there needs to be not just storytelling in one direction, teller, listener, but actually, even if one person's talking and there's listening, it feels like it's reciprocal. And the fact that that story's life does not end between those two people, that it's disseminated out into the world. The reason for this, I'll tell you, and I was going to say a bit about this, is the fact that the history of oral culture and storytelling is the fact that what one would do is tell somebody a story and be entertained or informed or moved or what have you. That person would go tell somebody else. If anything, Benjamin is not just the advocate of storytelling, he's the advocate of gossiping, right? He is to say, hear the story and share it with the world. That's how you give it legs and that's how you give it life. Let's continue here. This is the second sentence. And among those who have written down the tales, it is the great ones whose written version differs least from the speech of the many nameless storytellers. Incidentally, among the last named, there are two groups which, to be sure, overlap in many ways. And the figure of the storyteller gets its full corporeality only for the one who can picture them both. When someone goes on a trip, he has something to tell about, goes the German saying. And people imagine the storyteller as someone who has come from afar. But they enjoy no less listening to the man who has stayed at home, making an honest living, and who knows the local tales and traditions. So in other words, to be an explorer or adventurer is not a prerequisite to being qualified as being a storyteller. If one wants to picture these two groups through their archaic representatives, one is embodied in the resident tiller of the soil, and the other in the trading seaman. Indeed, each sphere of life has, as it were, produced its own tribe of storytellers. Each of these tribes preserves some of its characteristics centuries later. Thus, among 19th century German storytellers, writers like Hebel and Goethe stem from the first tribe. Writers like Seelsfield and Gerstacker from the second. With these tribes, however, as stated above, it is only a matter of basic types. The actual extension of the realm of storytelling, in its full historical breadth, is inconceivable without the most intimate interpretation of these two archaic tribes. Such an interpretation was achieved particularly by the Middle Ages in their trade structure. The resident master craftsman and the traveling journeyman worked together in the same rooms. And every master had been a traveling journeyman before he settled down in his hometown, or whatever, or somewhere else. If peasants and seamen were past masters of storytelling, the artisan class was its university. In it was combined the lore of faraway places, such as much traveled man brings home, with the lore of the past as it best reveals itself to natives of a place. I mention this now because what we're talking about here, Benjamin really is glorifying, I think, if you will, the journeyman, if you will, the traveling salesman, the seaman, the sailor, what have you, right? And also the laborer, the peasant, the person who works at home. I think an attempt to show the disparity between those two different lifestyles, one mobile, one sedentary, if you will, right? But also to almost democratize the value of storytelling, that it doesn't have to be a class-endowed thing, and it certainly doesn't have to be a literacy-endowed thing when we think about it. Now, how to translate that to the kind of reading we're doing in this room and the kind of discussions we're sort of having about different case histories this semester is to think then that, again, the background one has, the mobility or immobility that one hand is not a prerequisite to one's storytelling. In fact, Benjamin is setting up the playbook for why the ill, the infirmed, the injured, the disabled, people who are even immobile to some degree, why those stories can be just as tantalizing as the guy who is a seafarer and going off and doing things, and just as valuable. So the value of this tale then comes from not just the walk of life or the perspective that comes from, but also not from the education level or the class or the kind of privilege, if you will. So I mention this and I linger on this because what Benjamin is doing here is trying to think about historically, professionally, and categorically what counts as a story. And I think it's important for us because storytelling in the clinic is almost always related in some degree with a power dynamic too, mm-hmm. whether it's education or privilege or who's diagnosing or who's prognostic, prosticating or what have you, right? So if that power struggle is there, and it seems to be at the core of what Benjamin's talking about here culturally and socioeconomically and even Marxist-wise, I think in terms of the clinic, it's there for us just at the level of like the whole reason we have
narrative and bioethics. The whole reason we have this focus on storytelling is because we're sensitive to and mindful of, there's a power dynamic here that we need to be gracious to and mindful of. Different parties we need to listen to, and it's absolutely the playbook that's given for us here. Having said that, as I mentioned with the reciprocity and the dissemination, it's not an equation there that's sort of doing away with confidentiality or privilege or privacy or what have you. What it's doing is in some way letting the knowledge that happens within that relationship, the story that is told from storyteller to listener and the reciprocity that it happened, it can get disseminated in the world, not just because it's told, not just because what I shared with my story you're going to blab to everybody else, but because you'll know that it was reciprocal, you'll know that it's disseminated because of the fact that that person heard my story and it's going to change the way they live their life outside of that. So to give you an example, two people here telling a story, we know it's reciprocal, according to Benjamin, if the fact that the person has both appreciated what the other person has said and absorbed it. But we also know it's been disseminated either because they tell somebody else or because they share it or because I heard that story and I'm the same person when I leave after I've listened to it. That's its own kind of dissemination to some degree. It's not just blabbing, if you will. Let's look at a couple more moments and then we'll call it a day. This is on page... That's page... six. I should tell you this too, that one of the cornerstones of what Benjamin talks about in here is the fact that storytelling is so important, not because we just, you know, I hear you and you hear a story, but at the very reason we want to disseminate it, the very reason we want to continue to think about it or to share it with the world is because stories are important because they need to be told, but because they need to be retold. Stories are important not just because they need to be read, but because they need to be reread. An example I love about this is the really good example is the fact that, like, you know a movie is really good, right? When the fact that you either want to own it or if the fact that you want to re-rent it or re-get it, right? Which is to say that there's a value that comes from revisiting a story, revisiting a narrative. I think this is the cornerstone of that very dissemination that Benjamin is talking about here. To that end, as we read narratives in this class, think about the value of these stories not in the fact that we get to hear them. It's not just someone tells a story and someone listens to it's end of story, but the fact that if we linger on it afterwards, if we revisit it, if we reread it, and in fact, whenever we come in here and talk about those readings, assuming everyone's read them before they come in, what we're doing in here is rereading. That's what close reading is, and it's that revisitation that actually is the strength of storytelling. So the non-one-offness of it is really what's valuable, I think, about these narratives. Page six.